The Spider, the Cholera King, 5. Chapter 5. Disaster. Wentworth did not know when he yanked the throttle wide on the plane, but he became aware presently of the trembling vibration that the engine sent through the ship. Something was off balance somewhere. If it continued, it might shake the plane to pieces. But he could not lessen the mad pace. There was death in the northern sky. It might be that Nita had plunged down in flames. He held the throttle open, tried to ignore the quaking of the ship. If only one of those planes still circling, dodging across the sky, was the Northrop. Hope was beginning to swell within him. If both of those planes were enemy, why did they continue to dodge about? Leaning forward in his eagerness for speed, Wentworth kept his eyes narrowed on those circling ships. Abruptly, he laughed aloud. One of them was scarlet, and it had the lines of his Northrop. He was certain again that Nita still fought there against the guns of the enemy. And she had downed one of the killer planes. He was within a mile and a half of the dogfight when the enemy ship wheeled away to the east and raced off at top speed with the Northrop following hard behind it. Wentworth swung his ship about, but he knew there was no chance of its intercepting the fugitive, nor of staying in the chase. Both of the planes were faster than his. His teeth clamped together. This might well be a trick, a trap for Nita, and he was helpless. Doggedly, he clung to the pursuit, but soon the two planes faded away in the eastern sky. A grim fear clung to Wentworth. He had had time back there to see that Nita had averted an attack upon the stationary acid trains, but her work had been finished then. She should have abandoned the pursuit. A worried frown creased Wentworth's forehead as he turned his plane toward New York, lying smokily just upon the horizon. Within an hour, or an hour and a half at most, night would blacken all the sky. Nita might be ambushed by the very plane she pursued. Wentworth's lips tightened thinly. He was like a man with hands bound, forced to witness a vile murder. Nothing he could do would help Nita. True, there were fast planes in New York which he could commandeer, but by the time he could obtain one, there would be no chance of tracing her. Already there was no chance. There was a grimness about Wentworth as he left his rented plane at the Newark airport, which kept as many acquaintances there from speaking, which killed greetings on their lips. He was driving himself to a search for the man behind the plague. He tried to tell himself that Nita was safe, that he was needlessly alarmed, but his memory prodded him. More times than he cared to think about, Nita had fallen into enemy hands. True, he had always managed to snatch her from danger, but he couldn't always win. No human being could always win. Desperately, he thrust Nita from his consciousness, forced himself to concentrate on the search before him. If he could solve the murder of Christian Daly. There was no clear reason for thinking that Daly's murderers and the cholera spreaders were the same, and yet Wentworth was convinced that they were. It was one of the Spider's hunches, the logic of his subconscious brain which he could never afford to ignore. To police headquarters, he commanded the taxi driver and hurry. He drew from his pocket the notebook in which he had copied the designs which the murderer had inked on Daly's chest. He frowned over the characters. As he pointed out to Kirkpatrick, the symbols varied in shape. There were, for instance, ovals as well as circles, and the X marks were sometimes crosses and sometimes had one bar shorter than the other. There was the additional fact that each symbol's position in the diagram might alter its meaning. Why else should they be placed in diagrams? It had been some years since Wentworth had attempted deciphering, but he could recall that where variants were employed, that is, several symbols representing the same letter, or the same symbol representing several different letters, it immensely complicated the task. He began a classification of the figures, regarding each symbol in a certain position as a totally separate symbol. Before he had half finished the task, the cab drew up before police headquarters. He showed Kirkpatrick what he had done, and the commissioner smiled faintly. "We turned it over to Washington," he said. "They have the greatest cipher experts of the country there. Personally, I doubt that they mean anything at all. We have another set to work on now." Wentworth's eyes lifted quickly to his friend's saturnine face, and Kirkpatrick nodded grimly. "There have been two more murders, Scott Francis, of the Roscoe Steel Corporation, and Horace Todd, of the Hood Bank." He picked up a photograph from the desk, tossed it to Wentworth. "That's the layout on Francis. Haven't got one on Todd yet." It showed a man's chest, pierced by a bullet wound which had struck the heart. The bullet had gone through the center of the circle in the middle of a tic-tac-toe diagram, and there were four other diagrams. In two of those, The circle symbol had won. That is, there were three circles in a row and a line signifying victory had been drawn through them. Wentworth frowned, wondering if those three circles with a line should be considered a single letter, as he made a copy in his notebook. Kirkpatrick took back the photograph, tossed it carelessly on the desk. "It means nothing," he said. "I wouldn't be too sure," Wentworth objected slowly. "Did Raids have an alibi for Daly's murder?" "No, he didn't." Kirkpatrick dropped back into his chair, made a steeple with his fingers. "But we have only Carey's unsupported testimony that they even had an appointment. Raid says he doesn't remember, but his secretary has no record of it. He says, anyway, that he certainly didn't keep the appointment." Wentworth went slowly to the window, stared down at the deserted street, at the stone wall of the church on the corner. The emptiness was a mockery, and in the church, endless prayers were lifted that the cholera would end. Wentworth laughed shortly. There was a saying that God help those who help themselves. It would take more than prayers to end a man-made cholera epidemic. He forced his mind back to Raids. "Would he profit in any way by Daly's death?" he asked. "That seems to me to be the crux of the situation right now." Kirkpatrick frowned. "Not directly. Of course, Daly's death throws his controlling shares of the subway companies into the open market at a time when those stocks are dirt cheap, because of the cholera. By God, Dick, we may have hit something there. A definite tie-up between the cholera and the tit-tat-toe murders." Wentworth wheeled away from the windows. "How about Roscoe Steele? Scott Francis is chairman of the board. And Horace Todd, of the Hood Bank?" "That isn't so clear," Kirkpatrick mused slowly, "though of course Francis is the directing genius of Roscoe. If anything could make Roscoe Steele shaky, it would be Francis' death. I'm sure the stocks were off on the market this morning. I hold some of them. Yes, off considerably." "Todd? His bank stock isn't on the market. Do you think, Dick, that perhaps—" Wentworth smiled. "I think you know your job pretty damned well, Kirk. It's just talking this way sometimes that you can dig up fresh ideas. And by the way, none of this stuff points to Raids. There are 100 others who could profit equally well." Kirkpatrick got to his feet, put his hand on Wentworth's shoulder. "What a team we would make, Dick. What a team we do make." Wentworth laughed. "No, I will not be your deputy." Kirkpatrick laughed, turned away. "I'll put some men to watching Raids privately, and we'll check stock accounts on Wall Street. Frankly, though, unless the murders are definitely related to the cholera epidemic, the plague worries me a great deal more, especially now that you've proved there are men behind it. We may have to shut off the city water supply." Wentworth frowned. "In heaven's name, why? It would be disastrous. The sewage would clog up and spread fresh disease even if there were enough drinking fluids without the water. Won't the acid—" He stopped as he saw the harsh lines of Kirkpatrick's face. He cursed. "The acid got through," he cried. "It must have. Nita—" Kirkpatrick shook his head slowly. "I know you and Nita did your best, Dick," he said slowly. "We had reports of how you drove off the attacking planes, but the trains were blown up by bombs laid under the tracks about 50 miles out of New York. Two companies of the National Guard were almost wiped out besides that one you already know of." Wentworth's knuckles whitened as his hands clenched at his sides. He had been so sure, so sure. He should have known that a man who could so cleverly estimate the spider's moves when he fled ashore in the catapult plane would not have staked his venture on a single attempt to halt the trains. He said heavily. "Then the cholera continues to spread?" Kirkpatrick laughed harshly. "There are over 30,000 cases reported. Every hospital is jammed to overflowing and we have turned all the public buildings into contact ion wards. We can bury them fast enough. 30,000 cases will mean 20,000 dead within a day. Supplies of drugs and serum are exhausted, and—" The police newsprinter machine in a corner of the office set up an excited ringing, then began to clatter out letters. Wentworth and Kirkpatrick sprang to it, watched slow words jerk out on a strip of paper. "Big explosion Brooklyn waterfront investing flash squib drug warehouse blown up destroyed casualties unknown." Wentworth turned to face Kirkpatrick and the countenances of both men were gaunt. They knew without discussion what this meant. The master of the plague was making sure that medications would not check the spread of cholera. Kirkpatrick sprang to his phone, began barking orders to the guards who had been stationed at every medical warehouse and laboratory in the city. He ordered the men to search the buildings for planted bombs, and— The police printer shambled again and Wentworth's narrowed eyes saw more words of disaster went from the machine. He looked for fresh news of the Brooklyn explosion, but found that a second plant in Queens, a third in Manhattan, a fourth in Newark had been blown to bits. He whirled to Kirkpatrick, saw from the grayness of the commissioner's face, as he slowly replaced the phone, that he had already heard the news. "There's nothing else to do now," Kirkpatrick said dully, "except to turn off the water supply. We'll keep the sewage flushed with fire hoses, supply bottled goods for drinking. We'll try to bring in new supplies of acid, of course, and medicine. We'll increase the guards." He rose heavily to his feet. "Come, I'm going to the mayor's office." Wentworth shook his head. "You haven't found Daly's secretary, young Bill Carnes, yet, have you?"
"Good Lord, no,"
Kirkpatrick exploded.
"As if there were time to hunt for petty murderers now."
Wentworth nodded.
"I'll see you later."
He went swiftly to the door, stopped as Kirkpatrick caught his arm. "Dick, I need your help in this. Help me smash this epidemic,
and the man behind it.
Every criminal in town is on the rampage. There have been more killings, more robberies, in the last few hours than there usually is in a month of crime. The city is demoralized with panic and disease and the crooks."
Wentworth gripped Kirkpatrick's arm, shook it.
"I am helping you, Kirk," he said quietly.
"I'm going to find Carnes,
that youngster. He couldn't be responsible."
Wentworth agreed with a quick nod.
"But he must have a clue to the reason for Daly's murder. Perhaps he can confirm our theory about raids. When I find that, I'll have the answer to the plague." Before Kirkpatrick could protest again, Wentworth was gone, alive, quiet man whose gray blue eaves were masked to hide their fire. Hot wrath burned within Wentworth as he hastened in his taxi through the city's deserted streets. Buildings were closed, blinds drawn as if, like the light, they would shut out the plague. When men moved on the streets, it was furtively, with backward-flung glances over their shoulders. Did they think that death wore a visible shape these days? There were trucks which moved with heavy clangor from door to door. The men upon them wore surgical masks, and heavy rubber gloves upon their hands. Even so, their eyes were frightened. Wentworth saw them carry a covered body from a house and drop it fearfully into the truck. All over the city, Wentworth knew, these scenes were being enacted. Already the formality and the dignity were stripped from death, and the plague was no more than 48 hours old. Bodies of the dead no longer earned the reverence of the bereaved. They were dangerous things to be rid of as soon as possible, bearers of horrible death. The taxi driver turned a pallid face toward him.
"Geez,"
he whispered.
"Yaus is my last fare. When Yaus gets out, I'm pulling out of this hell town. I don't want to die. I got a wife and kids to feed."
He grinned weakly.
"Want to buy a nice taxi, cheap, mister?"
Wentworth smiled faintly in reply. "They won't let you leave town, you know. The city
is quarantined."
The driver laughed.
"Yeah?
Let em try and keep me here. They's hundreds skipping town every night, and I..." A queer, tortured light sprang into his eyes. He cried out hoarsely, frightened, and the cat swerved, hurtled the curb and rammed its nose into an office building. The driver kept uttering, shocked, terrified cries. He pitched to the floor and writhed there, retching. Wentworth was pitched violently to the floor, his forehead striking the back of the front seat. He crawled dazedly to the street, watched the cramped convulsions of the plague-stricken driver. What could be done for the man? The hospitals were crowded to overflowing, public buildings converted and filled, too. Without prompt medication, the man didn't stand a chance of recovery. There was a muffled shot and Wentworth sprang to the front of the cab. Then he stepped back, smiling terribly. The driver had had a gun. He had saved himself from the plague. Wentworth strode with choppy, furious paces along the street. He could not use the cab, contaminated as it now was. He turned across town, reached Fifth Avenue and hurried northward. There were no taxis in sight, but the moan of sirens, police and ambulance cars, made a constant whimpering through the streets, as if they bewailed in advance the death of the stricken they bore away. The heavy corpse trucks with their masked attendants clanged along, and not a few of them bore policemen in uniform, with drawn guns, who forced the men to their loathsome task. Abruptly, Wentworth halted. There, ahead of him, was a crowd. The sight of 100 people, crowded together in this time of plague, was a startling thing. These were days when men shunned their fellows as if each bore the sight of death in his hands. Striding briskly nearer, Wentworth saw that the crowd was filing slowly into the doors of the Hood Savings Bank. He checked near a line of men and women whose faces were drawn with fear.
"What's the matter?"
he demanded. "The Hood Bank is strong,
You aren't afraid of losing your mo, nay? The man he addressed turned a furtive face toward him. That's all you know, he sneered. It's on its last legs. The only man what could have saved it was Horace Todd, and he got killed. The man shook a newspaper at him. The tit-tat-toe guy. Wentworth frowned as he went swiftly on along the avenue. Vaguely, an idea was stirring at the back of his mind. He shook his head impatiently. Somebody who had been trying secretly to get control of the city subways. It hadn't been generally known. Daly's death would give him his opportunity. A woman's scream broke in upon his thoughts. He whirled toward the sound. The woman was old and, with her shoulders against a building wall, she clutched an old-fashioned, black purse with both her feeble arms. There were two men in front of her, one of them wrenching at the purse while the other tried to strangle her. The scene needed no explanation. Crooks were watching the bank on which there was a run, and when someone withdrew a rich haul, he was robbed. But the old woman was clinging to her money with surprising strength, though her cries were long since choked into silence. Wentworth whipped an automatic from its holster too late. The crook who was strangling the woman lost patience. He jerked his hand from her throat and there was a glitter of steel as he struck. The purse came free then, and the two men pelted down the street. The old woman stood with her frail shoulders against the building wall, her thin, veined hands clutching at her throat. Then she crumpled to her knees and pitched down on the pavement, an abandoned heap of black rags. Those things happen with the flickering speed of light, between the time Wentworth's hand started for his gun and the instant it came clear. His lips twisted hard against his teeth, as he threw down on the two killers. The heavy .45 crashed, jerking up with the recoil, dropped into line and crashed again. The first man, the one with the purse, twisted as he ran, his hands snatching at his companion, the purse dropping. He was already dead, his legs flinging awkwardly wide. The second shot hurled the other against him, making a tangle of twist of legs and arms on the pavement. Wentworth moved stiffly toward them, gun in hand. Behind him, men were shouting, women screaming. But not one left his place in the waiting line at the bank. Wentworth stood over the two men, a moment later stirred their limp bodies with his foot. They were dead enough, one with a convulsive hand still grasping a red knife. Slowly, Wentworth thrust the automatic back into its holster, his fingers went to a vest pocket where a platinum cigarette lighter rested. In its base was a mechanism that would print indelibly upon this dead flesh a small crimson seal that would brand these men as the prey of the spider. Did he dare to use it? Back there in the line, a man had seen his face. Besides, he had promised himself never again to use the spider seal while in his true identity. And yet the master of the plague needed a grim warning, needed to be reminded that the spider still lived. That sooner or later, the vengeance of this man who was the left hand of the law would strike him down. Only a moment did Wentworth pause. Then he stooped swiftly over the dead men and pressed the base of the cigarette lighter briefly to the forehead of each. Afterward, he went striding on. He was very lucky that there had been no police at the bank. Behind him, a man shouted with almost hysterical shrillness, "The spider! The spider!" That man was the spider. Wentworth did not look about, did not hasten his steps, though the shriek of a police siren heralded the swiftly approaching forces of the law. There would be a few moments before they could arrive, and by that time, he would reach the corner. Let him once turn it, and he defied the police to find him. He reached the corner, darted across the street into the trade entrance of an apartment building. He dashed up several flights of stairs, ran the automatic elevator down again and sauntered out through the front lobby. The police pursuit had already rounded the corner which the spider had turned a few swift moments before, following a false trail. At H.I.S. home, a few blocks away, Wentworth asked Jackson to bring his Daimler town car to the door. The Daimler was not quite so swift as the Hispano Suiza roadster he preferred, but it had one advantage: it was completely bulletproof, and it contained a hidden wardrobe and makeup materials which would probably prove invaluable in the coup he was planning. He made a swift change of clothing since police would have the description of the man who killed at the Hood Bank and entered the Daimler, the home of Christian Daly. He ordered Jackson and settled back against the cushions with his eyes closed. He began to consider the happenings of the day, to analyze the diagrams of the tit-tat-toe murderer, but his mind was weary. The summer twilight lay like purple smoke upon the city, and he realized that the long hours of battle that lay behind without rest, with scanty and hasty meals, had taken toll of his vitality. Was Nita still up there in that darkening sky, pursuing the fugitive enemy to the bitter end? His lips twisted as he thought how bitter that end might be, a flaming death plunge from the ceiling of the world. He jerked his head as if to shake off the thought, opened his eyes upon the deserted street through which he was gliding. There was a lurid glow across the northern horizon. For an instant it puzzled him, and then he understood, and grimness cut deep lines about his mouth. They were the biers of the dead, the plague-ridden who died too swiftly to be buried, who could not be buried lest their very bodies further contaminate the earth and the waters. Evelyn Daly refused to see Wentworth when first he entered the black-draped portals of her murdered foster father's home. Having finally descended, she was totally different from the frightened girl she had been earlier in the day. Her dress was an unrelieved black, and it made her face a startling white in contrast, widened her blue eyes to immensity. If she had wept, there was no redness now to betray it. Wentworth bowed with the courtly formality that was his. "What business have you here?" Evelyn demanded, her tone bitter. "You tried to kill—" She choked on the word, pulled up her firm round chin, and repeated it quietly. "To kill the man I love." Wentworth stood silent, smiling. His eyes, which could glance with deadly fire, were very gentle. He gestured toward the drawing room and, after a moment's hesitation, Evelyn went in and seated herself. Wentworth dropped into a chair facing her, offered a cigarette which she refused. "Do you mind?" Wentworth asked quietly, taking a cigarette himself. The girl shook her head, and abruptly the controlled dignity went out of her. She dropped against the cushions of the davenport, her head bent forward, and slow, big tears slid across her cheeks. "Oh, hurry, hurry," she cried, her voice muffled. "Can't you see?" Wentworth watched her and waited until the tears stopped. "What I wanted to tell you," he said finally, "is that when I shoot at a target, I hit it. I would give you a demonstration, but it might disturb your servants. Really, Miss Daly, I did not attempt to kill Carnes today, but to prevent a policeman from shooting him." The girl lifted her head with an effort, met his gaze with great, liquid eyes.
"You mean that you deliberately missed Bill?" Doubt was in her voice. Wentworth smiled slightly. Drawing an automatic, he said, "I'll take a chance on alarming the servants. What would you call a difficult target?" Evelyn Daly looked at the gun with wide eyes, her lip caught beneath small, even teeth. She flung out an arm rigidly. "Oh, I do want to believe you," she cried. "I do need a friend in Bill Doe's. There, that rose in the vase." She was pointing the length of the room, across the wide hallway to the music room beyond, where, against the wall, a flower vase stood upon a grand piano. Scarcely had her last word left her lips when Wentworth fired. He did not aim in the work to which he had pledged himself. There could be no such thing as aiming. He had trained himself to shoot accurately by pointing. Nor did his skill fail him. The rose leaped from its stem, severed between the flower and the fragile lip of the vase. "You see," Wentworth said, "it would be difficult for me to miss a target as large as a man." Evelyn Daly sat with her hands pressing stiffly down into her lap. A startled butler floundered into the hallway and she smiled toward him wanly. "Nothing, Peterson," she said. "I asked Mr. Wentworth to show me how to shoot." The butler's dignity was outraged. He stalked indignantly away and his stilted voice could be heard explaining to other servants. Evelyn was staring fixedly into Wentworth's eyes. "I believe you, now," she whispered. "I believe you, but why should you care? What difference does it make whether I believe you or not?" Wentworth had holstered his gun. He moved now to a seat beside Evelyn Daly and her head swung with his movements, her eyes holding his. "I want you to know that I am your friend, and Bill Carnes' friend," he said. "I want you to take me to Carnes so that he can help me find your father's murderer." The girl cried no. Her eyes widened almost hypnotically. Then abruptly she was crying on Wentworth's shoulder, her slender body shaken by sobs. "We do need help," she cried. "We need it so." It was a half hour later that Jackson tooled the Daimler into the street and sent it whispering through the empty thoroughfares of Manhattan. Evelyn had insisted on going with Wentworth to the hideout, a tiny apartment which, a week ago, she and Carnes had rented as their future home. They had planned to elope, to rely on Daly's forgiveness later. If he refused, well, they would manage somehow. It was to this place that Carnes had fled from the police. "They papered it over just to suit us," Evelyn was saying, with a wry smile. "The living room was really smaller than we wanted, but we took it anyway. It's lovely, a creamy white with a widely spaced design of cross fronds. They're in gold. We were so happy." She was crying again, silently, without sobs, smiling while she did it.
Wentworth took one of her slender hands, closed her fingers in upon the palm.
"You will be happy," he told her gravely.
"You must hold to that idea tightly."
His face was set harshly. These young dreams could still hurt him, though it had been long since he could dream so with Nita. But he still could try to realize the dream for others. It was for such service that he had dedicated his life. Carnes and this girl had done no wrong that they should be prosecuted. Neither had those other thousands whom the plague had smitten. A coldness crept through his veins, poured fury into his brain. How much longer would this damnable master of the plague he allowed to crush humanity beneath his iron-shod tread? How much longer? Beside him, Evelyn gasped. Wentworth checked his thoughts with difficulty, turned toward her. She was crouched back in the far corner of the seat, her eyes frightened, wide. He shook himself, drove the anger from him. The girl shuddered.
"Your face," she whispered.
"What were you thinking? You frighten me."
The Daimler slid to a halt before a small apartment house of white brick, precisely like four other apartment houses in the same block. Wentworth helped Evelyn to the pavement.
"I was thinking," he said quietly,
"of the men who killed your father."
Evelyn laughed nervously.
"I'm glad you don't suspect Bill."
There was no elevator, and Wentworth followed the girl's quick steps up short, twisting flights of stairs. She was in eager haste. Up there, her lover was waiting. Wentworth's lips twisted a little with his thoughts as he followed her. She was fumbling awkwardly in her purse, standing before a door precisely like all those other doors. But behind this one, her lover waited. Behind it was her home to be, with its creamy wallpaper and its fronds of gold. With a little cry of impatience, Evelyn snatched a key from the depths of the purse, jimmied it into the lock and pushed the door open.
"Bill,"
she cried.
"It's Evelyn."
She ran along the bare hall.
"Bill."
"Bill?"
Wentworth's lips tightened in swift alarm.
He reached the living room in two long strides. Evelyn had a hand braced against the wall. The arm wilted and Wentworth caught her just as she sagged to the floor in a dead faint. The room was empty, but on the parquet were a half dozen scattered, dark spots, and on the wallpaper, between the golden fronds, were a half dozen diagrams of tit-tat-toe.
End of chapter 5.